Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Late-term abortions. The House will try once again to have them banned by overriding President Clinton's veto. We'll have a debate.
The Child Protection Fund hopes to inform many more Americans about this brutal procedure in an effort to stop the acceptance of barbarism under the guise of compassion.
I cannot imagine living in a society where a government would force a woman to carry a doomed pregnancy to term, even if that meant imperiling her life and ultimately her health.
We'll talk with two women who've had late-term abortions and one who chose not to. Also, first it was the Moral Majority, then the Christian Coalition, now it's the Promise Keepers, and they're packing stadiums around the country.
And if this woman is going to submit to us this way, then let me tell you something, guys. We're going to give her a reason to submit.
We are very grateful for you. We need you. We ask you to forgive us for not showing you respect and the honor you deserve.
A look at the third wave of the religious right. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton has declared a 1.7 million acre area of southern Utah's Red Rock Cliffs and Canyons as a national monument. He said we can't have mines everywhere and we shouldn't have mines that threaten our national treasures. He was speaking at the Grand Canyon National Park in Arizona. Speaking in San Francisco, Reform Party candidate Ross Perot was clearly furious that the Commission on Presidential Debates has excluded all third-party candidates from the official debates.
Half the commissioners are Democrats, half of them are Republicans. It is funded by corporations and foundations who have a lot at stake here.
Perot will be suing in federal court, and he also had protesters go out to Bob Dole's speech to dog him as they demanded invite Perot. Perot again speaking in San Francisco.
Men or man is the promise keeper, but watch this. Wives become the promise reapers.
And we're going to be bringing you a report on the promise keepers later in the show. As for Bob Dole, he's coined a new catchphrase for fighting drug abuse, just don't do it. Dole also continued his critique of the entertainment industry, singling out two popular movies, Pulp Fiction and Trainspotting, that he said glamorize heroin use. Just don't do it is a takeoff on Nike's slogan, just do it. Some might say Nike should be told just don't do it when it comes to exploiting its workers overseas in Indonesia. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Lawyers for death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal have asked a judge to reopen his appeal hearing because a witness now says she lied at the trial under police pressure. Veronica Jones has recanted her testimony in the 1982 trial of Abu-Jamal, a former radio reporter and Black Panther who was convicted of killing Daniel Faulkner, a Philadelphia police officer. Jones said after a hearing on Wednesday on whether to allow her new testimony, I have a conscience just like everybody else. All I'm going to tell is the truth. Shortly after Faulkner's murder in 1981, Jones, then a 21-year-old prostitute, told police she saw two unidentified men leave the murder scene. At trial, though, she testified that she had been mistaken and hadn't seen anyone. Earlier this year, Jones said her initial statement was correct. She said police had visited her in jail, where she was being held on an armed robbery charge, and pressured her to lie. Abu-Jamal's lawyers argued that the recantation must reopen the appeal hearing, since it undermines other testimony against him and shows prosecutors withheld evidence of police coercion. Abu-Jamal is seeking a new trial. Well, the House is expected to take up the issue of late-term abortions today. They're expected to try to override President Clinton's veto. It's expected the Senate will take the vote up next week. We're joined by three people to debate the issue of late-term abortions. We're joined by Vicki Stella in Washington, D.C. She was 8 months pregnant and eagerly anticipating the birth of her third child when she received devastating news. Her fetus had numerous serious anomalies and would not survive. survive. Vicki Stella was also a diabetic. Vicki Wilson will join us. She's a registered nurse and a mother of two, married to an emergency room physician. She, too, was eagerly anticipating the birth of her child, but she received a clean bill of health after the usual battery of tests, although it turns out that a final ultrasound detected that her fetus had encephali. And we will talk about that in a minute. We're also joined by Terry Heineman on the telephone. She's the mother of four. At 7 months, into 7 months of her pregnancy, the doctor recommended she have a late-term abortion because her fetus was suffering from the same malady. She chose not to have that abortion. Her child died at the age of 5 months. We're going to turn first to Vicki Stella. You may have seen some ads that have gone out on TV that actually use the story of Vicki Stella to support President Clinton's veto of the late-term abortion ban. Vicki Stella, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you tell us your story?
Thank you and good morning. Okay, in my third pregnancy, in a much-wanted pregnancy, being a diabetic, you have more prenatal testing than most women. And I had gone in for a routine ultrasound at 25 weeks. The doctor called me that evening, and his exact words to me were, "Vic, you're disgustingly normal, and so is the baby." Well, at that time, I breathed a big sigh of relief. We started preparing for our son, started getting his room ready. I was buying clothes, and my daughters, they were making baby blankets and bibs, and we were so excited. I had two older daughters, 11 and 7 at the time, so they were ecstatic. It was a baby they were bringing. I was bringing in. And then I went in for an ultrasound at 32 weeks, and the technician became very, very quiet. And I thought, well, I knew he was breech. Maybe that's the problem. She wanted to take me to the doctor right then, brought me up to the office. The doctor could not see me at that time, but since I had an appointment the next morning, I would see the doctor. He called that morning, approximately 6:45 a.m., and said that the baby had stopped growing at 25 weeks and that I needed to do some further testing just to see what was happening. So after determining everything that was wrong with my son, we found out that he had 9 anomalies. One was including that he was a rhizomelic dwarf. He had no brain tissue. He had a fluid-filled cranium only, no brain tissue at all. He had a flattened, compacted vertebrae. His hands were deformed. His feet were deformed. His eyes were on the side of his head. His ears were basically on his neck. And he had several other deformities. So I chose to have the intact DNA. As a diabetic, I have quite a few risks that maybe not the everyday woman would have.
When you say an intact DNA, explain what that is.
The intact DNA is where they... Well, that's the big fight in Congress. They've coined the phrase partial birth abortion. It's not a partial birth abortion. There's no such medical term, partial birth abortion. Do you want to know how this happens, the procedure?
Yes, the intact dilation extraction.
Okay. For me, it was a matter of over 3 days. And each day I went in 2 times where they completely put me under. At that time, they inserted what they called laminaria, and it's kind of like a sponge-like. This is how I'm not a doctor, so my medical terms are not. They're a sponge-like that soak up the fluid and dilate the cervix gradually. And you do this twice a day until your cervix is large enough to deliver the infant. Now, unless you are at term, you cannot bring your cervix to 10 centimeters. It's still too thick and too long. It will not do that. So we have to do it gradually and through the laminaria. And then once you are ready and the baby is ready to be born, then the doctor, of course, puts you out again. And then the baby is brought through, and there were no scissors used. Let me make that perfectly clear. There were no scissors used, and there was no brain sucking. The doctor uses then a spinal tap needle to remove some fluid from the head so it can safely come through the cervix without injuring the cervix.
Let's go to Vicki Wilson. We're first just going to briefly get the stories of each of you, and then we'll talk about this bill in Congress. Vicki Wilson, can you tell us your story when you had your late-term abortion?
Yes, and good morning. 2 years ago, at 36 weeks of pregnancy, after you had stated that all my prenatal testing had come back negative, it was discovered that the majority of my daughter's brain had been formed on the outside of her skull, and that what had been formed was basically abnormal. There was no anatomy to the brain at all. So we were given options, and my husband and I, being in the medical field, weighed them very heavily, knowing all the implications that would be involved. And we, too, chose the intact DNA.
And what happened after you had this? How did you feel?
Well, I felt that we had made the right decision. One of the things that also was discovered that what I thought to be big, healthy movements of my daughter was, in fact, seizures, which was being caused by the external pressure on her brain because it wasn't protected by the skull. So she was actively seizing while inside my womb. And my response was I wanted to put her out of suffering because I felt that she was indeed suffering inside.
Let's now go to Terry Heineman, who joins us on the phone now from Virginia. Can you tell us the story of your pregnancy?
Yes. Good morning, Amy, and thank you for inviting me. I had an opportunity to speak to at a congressional hearing on July 4th, and I'd just like to share a little bit of that information with your listeners. My husband and I have had three children biologically, and we've adopted three more. Two of our children were born with a genetic abnormality called 5P trisomy. Our second daughter also had a condition called hydrocephalus, which is an increase in fluid in the brain cavity, which would make delivery, especially a vaginal birth, very difficult. The medical prognosis for our children was that they would have, at best, a short life with minimal development. Some of the medical professionals that we consulted with recommended abortion for our second daughter, Mary Ann. Others were ready to help support her life, and we chose life for both of our daughters. And that decision did carry some hardships. However, God really blessed us during their short lives. Our first daughter, Elizabeth, was diagnosed after she was born. We were deeply saddened learning about her genetic abnormality, but we desired to give her the best life that we could. Though she could never say a word and could not sit up on her own, she clearly knew us, and with all of our family and friends, she smiled, laughed, clapped her hands, and she was a joy to us for 2.5 years. We clearly saw how many lives she had touched when over 200 people attended her memorial mass. One child was touched in a very special way when he received her donated liver, and two others received sight through her eyes. 2 years later, we had a son born. He is healthy, and he is 9 years old now. And our third child, Mary Ann, was our daughter who had been diagnosed with hydrocephalus while I was 7 months pregnant. And as I mentioned, hydrocephalus is a medical condition where there's extra fluid in the brain cavity, and it also meant that her head was quite enlarged. At 7 months, we were given the choice to terminate the pregnancy or to treat both of us as patients, mother and child. We chose to have a cesarean section delivery. She was born prematurely, but she was born at about 8 months, and she received care in the neonatal intensive care unit while I recovered from the cesarean section delivery. We learned to feed her through a gavage tube because she wasn't strong enough to suck. Our son, who was 3 years old at the time, developed a special bond with his sister, and during the next 5 months as a family, we spent learning, growing, caring for each other and for our precious daughter. When she died, we celebrated her life at a memorial mass with family and friends. We had two medical necessities. One was a cesarean section to safely deliver Mary Ann in spite of her unusually large head. The second medical necessity was the neurosurgery to insert a shunt into Mary Ann's head to regulate the fluids in her brain. Partial birth abortion was not a medical necessity. The cesarean section delivery allowed both of us, mother and child, the best medical care given in the circumstances. And during the time that I spoke before the congressional representatives, many of us were watching the Olympics on TV, and struck my husband and I that during the medal-winning athletes never described their coaches or practice sessions as easy. They were thankful that their coaches were very demanding, and life and training for the athletes was not very comfortable. Their profiles show how determined and dedicated they were to becoming the best they could be. And it occurred to us that the frail children whose fate is being debated may be the toughest and best coaches God is sending to the earth. They challenge us to become better people. We, and as parents, and we as a society, we're challenged to love and to give selflessly to our children. And we must be determined to provide love and care for their physical and emotional needs. And on a personal note, my son, who's now 9, remembers very fondly the short life of his sister, and especially when she held his finger and squeezed it. And recently, last week, we attended a press conference by the cardinals and bishops of the United States, along with many other leaders in the religious community, who had a press conference and also had a prayer service. When my son said, I invited my son to go with me to the prayer service because he had just studied American government in third grade. I wanted to let him see how government really works. And he said, Mom, what really is partial birth abortion? And I had to tell him the truth. I had to describe that the baby is turned into a breech position inside the womb and then pulled out of the birth canal by the feet. And then when the baby's head remains inside the mother and the doctor punctures the skull with scissors, and then inserts a tube to suck the baby's brains out. And I was saddened to have to tell him that, but the look of shock and sadness across his face, I'll never forget that, because as a 9-year-old, he could see that this is not a procedure that is humane and certainly not very safe.
So, Terry Heinerman, you decided not only not to have a late-term abortion yourself, but you are one who feels that no woman should have a late-term abortion and are supporting the attempt by both the House and the Senate to overturn President Clinton's veto.
I agree with the attempt to override the veto because it really is not a safe procedure. Dr. DeCook, who was at the hearing, I'd like to quote him. He said, as a matter of fact, with regard to safety, there is no literature that attests to the safety of partial birth abortion. There is no literature that even mentions it, really. It is a maverick medical procedure made up by maverick doctors for the purpose of delivering a dead fetus. That is the sole purpose of the puncture of the head. It does facilitate by some minutes the delivery of the head through the cervix, but really the procedure is made up to deliver a dead fetus, and this, of course, has been admitted to by the practitioners of this art. And I would just like to say that I don't know that we can call ourselves a compassionate and caring and humane society if we feel that this particular procedure is acceptable to us. And I think that the reason that people on both sides of the aisle in the House and Senate are looking at this, it's not just a pro-life, pro-choice issue. This particular procedure is, as Senator Santorum described it this morning, barbaric. That if we're looking at delivering 7th, 8th, and 9-month-old babies, and then pulling them out partially, and then causing their death by puncturing a hole in their skull and then removing their brains, this isn't humane, and this certainly isn't safe.
Terry Heinerman, we're going to get the reaction of both Vicki Wilson and Vicki Stella when we come back. Again, we're talking about late-term abortions because the House is expected to attempt to override President Clinton's veto of the late-term abortion ban. The Senate is expected next week to take up the issue. At least at this count, the Senate doesn't look like it has enough votes to do it, although there are some senators, like Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, who is reconsidering his position and could possibly support the ban. We're waiting to see on that. Also, Senator Sam Nunn has suggested he, too, is reconsidering his position on the issue. We are talking to Vicki Wilson and Vicki Stella, both who had late-term abortions, Terry Heinerman, who chose not to. We're going to go back to this discussion, and then after that, we're going to look at the Promise Keepers. They're coming to New York this week, expecting to pack Shea Stadium with something like 35,000 Promise Keepers, the third wave of the American religious right. We'll speak with one of the people who's been following them. That's all coming up on Democracy Now! Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and I should also say, in other women's health news, the drug RU486, an alternative to surgery for abortion, has passed its last major hurdle yesterday on the way to becoming available to women in the United States. The Food and Drug Administration said that the controversial French pill was safe and effective when used under a doctor's close supervision. But the FDA withheld final approval until it receives more information about how the drug would be manufactured and labeled. It should be in doctors' offices by mid to late 1997, according to the Population Council, the nonprofit group that has the U.S. rights to market the drug. The drug already is being used by 200,000 European women. It has long been the focus of an emotional debate between abortion rights supporters and abortion opponents. But right now, what we're talking about is the other big news in the last 24 hours, and that is that the House today is going to try to override President Clinton's veto of late-term abortion ban that was passed by the House and Senate a couple of months ago. We're joined now by three women who know this issue well. Vicki Wilson is a registered nurse and the mother of two, and she was anticipating the birth of her third child when a sonogram detected that her fetus had serious birth defects, a condition where the brain grows outside the head. Vicki Stella also joins us. She was 8 months pregnant and awaiting the birth of her child when she learned that her fetus also had numerous serious anomalies. They both decided to have late-term abortions, and were joined on the telephone by Terry Heinerman, a mother of four now. She had six children. One daughter died, and another daughter who was 7 months, well, a fetus, 7 months, when Terry Heinerman was 7 months pregnant, it was discovered she had serious abnormalities, but Terry Heinerman decided not to terminate the pregnancy. I wanted to go back to Vicki Stella and get your response to Terry Heinerman's support for the late-term abortion ban, saying that it's simply inhumane and not compassionate.
Well, first of all, I'd like to know if she had any underlying medical problems such as diabetes.
Terry Heinerman.
My doctors took a look at all of my medical history, and I understand that you do have diabetes and that obviously need to be taken into consideration. I did see you this morning on a show, and you did pose the question, how can they judge me? Vicki, I'm not here to judge you. I think that some of the women that we've been talking to on this issue may have received poor medical guidance or information, but the doctors in the FACT group, it's the Physicians Ad Hoc Committee for Truth, one of the doctors is a perinatologist, and that's his job, to help women and their children go through this safely, and for whatever hours or minutes or days that the children can live, they want to allow them to do that. So I'm not here to judge you. You received medical
That's
information.
That's not my question. I'm asking you if you had
and I received
any underlying
the choice
medical
to
condition.
Have a cesarean section, and I chose that, and I was able to hold and love and cherish my daughter for 5 months.
No, Terry, you didn't, though, have an underlying medical condition. Is that right?
No, I did not.
Vicki?
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. I'm sorry you lost your children. We as mothers who have lost our children, whether they're at birth or even 5 minutes later, it's a tragedy. I've lived the tragedy, too. I'm still living the tragedy. But now the tragedy comes where Congress is in my doctor's office. I made the decision with knowledge I have on my medical condition. I have had people judge me. Yes, maybe you didn't abort. But you know what? That's where choice comes in. You had the choice not to. You have the choice to, and you have the choice not to. And that's where choice comes in.
Well, Senator Santorum mentioned this morning when he was with you on Fox Morning News that this bill is about one procedure, that if women are faced with these tragic situations, there are choices to be made. One of the choices, obviously, is a cesarean section. But this particular procedure, looking at it and what it does, the purpose is there's no benefit. There's no benefit to a woman to have, as you said, for 3 days, the risk of infection to you, going under anesthesia for 3 days, and all the information that I received at that hearing, it really opened my eyes. From what I see, that there's, for myself and for you, obviously you were able to have another child.
That's
having
right.
your child that had the anomalies, I my heart goes out to you. But I think that we do have other options available, and this particular procedure, I can't see
what other
how that is a good
what
option.
What other options
especially when
were
all
available
the other doctors are saying that there's no medical benefit and there's no medical necessity for this particular procedure.
That's
when
a handful
of
doctors, and why would another
canal.
Doctor say that it is?
Terry Heinerman, Vicki Stella's point is that for her, she had no other options, yet that you want to make the procedure that she had illegal, even in her case where she had no other option in terms of threat to her own health.
Well, did her doctor recommend a cesarean section?
No.
Well, maybe that's the case
section.
Where Dr. DeCook said that he does identify and feel that these are honest people who want to do the best thing, but maybe they were misguided in their in the medical options that were given to them. Because I know women who are diabetic, and obviously their pregnancies can be very difficult, but they've been able to deliver children. And
normal babies.
Perhaps a cesarean section may have given you a few minutes, a few hours to
once
have
that
time with your child.
Once that umbilical cord is cut, a child without a brain cannot survive. I have had people tell me that I should have given birth to this child and gotten to know his personality. Can you believe that? A child without a brain has no personality. Excuse me?
I was willing to do that even if I was only had a half an hour to be with my child.
That was your choice.
And I fortunately had 5 months with her, and it was very difficult. She needed to be fed every 4 hours through a gavage tube. But the love that created her with the grace of God is what helped my husband and I to, you know, take on the care for her. And as I said about the Olympic athletes, none of these decisions are easy.
Absolutely nothing.
They have to train. They have to work hard, and they reap a reward. My reward right now is the peace of in my heart knowing that I loved and cared for, and when God called my children back, that they were able to go to Him, and that we did the best we could for our children. And that was my decision. And I do think that women, there are a lot of choices out there, but I don't see that this particular procedure is a choice that is a good choice.
Terry Heinerman, let's go to Vicki Wilson for a minute. She, too, is a Catholic, wanted to see her third child born. What are you feeling right now as Terry Heinerman speaks?
I would like to point out that I, too, respect an individual's choice, be that to go through the pregnancy or not. And the condition that Terry described as of hydrocephaly is not a condition incompatible with life. Children can, as hers did, go on with shunts and whatever else the medical necessities are. Each situation needs to be weighed on its own merits, and to just blanket say that this issue is black and white, I believe, is incorrect. Let me just quickly run down my options. My daughter had her brain on the outside of her skull. She was seizing. My immediate response was, let's do a C-section. Let's get her out. And the doctor looked at me and said, Vicki, you know, we do C-sections to save babies. And a C-section in your case, because your uterus is not ready, I would have had to have had a hysterotomy, not the typical bikini line C-section. And that would compromise any future pregnancies. I would always have to have a C-section, and there would be the risk of a uterine rupture as the future pregnancies progressed. And the biggest thing, though, that made me decide definitely I did not want a C-section was that once the baby came out and the cord was cut, she would have suffocated, and I would have had to have watched that because she would have not been able to go on life support. Because with your brain on the outside of your skull and it being largely abnormal, there's no nerve intervention that would have allowed her to even take a breath. I did not want to watch that. The next options were, if it felt that if my pregnancy progressed, and because of the size of this anomaly, it felt that if I had gone into either an induced or spontaneous labor, that my uterus would have ruptured, again, rendering me sterile. And that was not an acceptable option to me. That's why we chose the intact DNE, because it was, yes, it does take 3 days, but we are given antibiotics. We are given a lot of precautionary measures to avoid infection. It actually acts more like the birthing process. And I'm going to get off on a tangent here. One thing I do want to mention, though, is that this is being portrayed as that we are killers and that we have no conscience or no compassion for our children. My kids were there when this procedure took place. I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they held her after she was delivered. We, too, had a mass. We, too, had about 250 people at a funeral. She is very much integrated into our lives and our family. Even though she was not alive on the outside, she had already become a very important part just through the pregnancy. My daughter, Caitlin, used to read to her. So we had a sense of who she was, and we really felt, and if this happened again, I would have no qualms about repeating it. I would do exactly the same thing. And again, I want to stress that each situation needs to be weighed on its own merits. And for a physician who does not have my records in his hand to presume that he knows everything involved is incorrect. There's no way they can make that judgment.
Let's talk about what you all are doing now as this bill, as what many may consider an extremely personal decision, becomes a major political issue, with the House today expecting to attempt to override President Clinton's veto of the late-term abortion ban. What are both Vicki Stella and Vicki Wilson, what are you doing politically to try to maintain the veto that President Clinton issued a few months ago? And Terry Heinerman, what are you doing on your side to try to make sure that it's overridden? Let's begin with Terry.
Well, first of all, I'm just praying a lot. I feel that there's the truth of the matter is not just a pro-life, pro-choice issue, but it's a basic respect for human life issue. And I think that the decisions that are made this week by the House and next week by the Senate are really going to say a lot about our country as a whole. All the issues that come after this, welfare, child protection and safety, they all boil down to a basic respect for life. And I think that if as a country we're saying that this procedure is something that's acceptable to us because the president says it's acceptable, then I feel very badly for this country.
Terry, I think the truth
needs to come out.
I wanted to ask what you also and both Vickies feel about the idea that actually I heard one male Congress member talk about the idea that men shouldn't be involved with this decision, that only women should be allowed to vote on this.
It's not a woman's issue. My husband was very much a part of my daughters as I was, and all the decisions we made were together. And unfortunately, sometimes the men, I think, are being left out of this. But the way God made families was mothers, fathers, and children. And it's a shame to think that men are being left out of this debate.
So in this week, are you scheduled to meet with Congress members and senators to talk about your own story and to urge them to override President Clinton's veto?
Yes. I had some appointments set up this afternoon, and it looks like one of the votes may be coming this afternoon. So this coming week, I will be available to Congress or whoever needs to find out about what we went through, why we went through it, and why we feel that life is precious.
Vicki Stella, what are you doing this week?
Well, this week I've been doing several press conferences and radio spots, and I'm out there. I'm out there. I've been out there since June of '95, and I'm not going away. She does not have an underlying medical problem, and this is one of the big issues. There is no health exception in this veto or this bill. Then that's why the president vetoed it. If maybe she watched the press conference with the president, how he said he would have signed it had there been a health exception. That health exception, if not there, would not have saved my life. This is, it's simple. We need to save women's lives.
Terry Heinerman, if there is a threat to the woman's life, do you feel she should be able to have a late-term abortion?
Well, I think Senator Santorum said it better this morning, that the health exception is very broad. It talks about depression, financial, social, different pressures that women are under. In Vicky's case, she had diabetes, and that's a serious condition.
So do you think she should be allowed to have a late-term abortion?
I think that she would need to consult with doctors to get the best care for her and her baby.
But if the law was passed and there was a ban on this, she would not have that choice as the law stands now.
As Senator Santorum said, that there are procedures that would be available to her that would not be as brutal as this partial birth abortion.
Vicki Wilson, you're a nurse in addition to being a mother and a woman who went through one of these late-term abortions. Do you know what one of those procedures would be?
That's an excellent question. In our cases, there were no other options. So basically, this legislation would ban women like me and their physicians from choosing one of the safest medical procedures available for us. So I heard Senator Santorum this morning as well, and he says there are other things out there available. The medical experts that I consulted with all agreed that, first of all, they gave me a choice. None of the physicians that I consulted with said I would best be served by choosing an abortion. They were all willing to go along with whatever I chose.
I mean, in fact, in your case, Vicki Stella was talking about a health exception, and President Clinton said he would have not overridden this bill if there was a health exception. In your case, you would not fall under that because it wasn't your health that was threatened.
Right. Immediately, it wasn't. I mean, you could have even called my situation an elective, simply because I did it at a time when my life was not in jeopardy. I wasn't willing to wait and see what happened because I had two other children at home to take care of, and I was thinking about them as well as my husband because we do function as a family unit.
Vicki Stella, as we wrap up this discussion, your thoughts on what would happen if this bill is overridden, although at this point it doesn't look like the Senate has enough votes, though there's a lot of lobbying going on. I know that the Child Protection Fund, they said they're putting in something like $1 million into ads and lobbying in these next few days. And on their board sits people like C. Everett Koop. What would you do if this ban were overridden?
Well, it may be overridden.
Rather,
in the House.
If the Clinton's veto was overridden and the ban was reinstated.
Well, I don't believe it's going to be overridden with the Senate, but if it does, I guess we'll be going to the Supreme Court.
And let me ask your reaction to this. There are many Democrats who consider themselves pro-choice, who call themselves pro-choice, like Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, like Congressmember David Bonier, Dick Gephardt. They are pushing for an override of President Clinton's veto. This may surprise some. What is your reaction to that?
Oh, I think they've been misled. By everybody. Everybody has been misled from day one on this procedure. Number one, we're looking at health, life. If you would have listened to the president, he said serious adverse health consequences. But the bishops come up with can't fit in the prom dress. Now let's see who makes any sense here.
I think it's important not to get on personal attacks here. And as I said earlier, I'm not here to judge anyone, but I think that we need to look at the truth of this issue. I think that the people in the Senate and the House that are pro-choice, and they're looking at this procedure, and they're seeing that to deliver a baby in a breech position and to do what they're doing to that baby isn't safe. And it's not necessary.
On this note, we have to wrap up this discussion. Again, we've been talking to three women, two who had late-term abortions, one who chose not to. On this day that the House is considering, well, a number in the House are trying to override President Clinton's veto of an abortion, a late abortion ban. Next week, the Senate is expected to take up the issue. At least at this point, they don't have the votes to override that veto. I want to thank Vicki Stella as well as Vicki Wilson, both who have shared their stories today, and Terry Heinerman on the phone with us, who also talked about why she chose not to have this late-term abortion. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up next, we're going to look at the Promise Keepers. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our next subject today is an issue that is coming here to New York. Tens of thousands of men are expected to pack Shea Stadium on Friday night. They are there as the Promise Keepers. And we're joined now by Al Ross. He is the founder and director of Sterling Research Associates, and he's been following the Promise Keepers over the years. He is formerly the director of the Research Institute at the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Promise Keepers, the third wave of the American religious right, is the name of his report. Welcome to Democracy Now! Al Ross, tell us who they are.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Joe Connison and my associate Lee Cocorinos and I have an article coming out in The Nation magazine in the current issue on Promise Keepers. Promise Keepers represents what we call the third wave of the efforts of the American religious right to dramatically transform our American democratic system. It represents a major effort by them, and we call the first wave Falwell's movement, followed by Robertson. The third wave...
Falwell, of course, the Moral Majority.
Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition. This third wave is distinguished from the first two in the extremism of its theology by the enormous infrastructure and organizational capability that's put together and by its extraordinary goal of dramatically transforming American social and religious relationships. Promise Keepers, over the past couple of years, and it was set up in 1990, has been packing football stadiums with white, overwhelmingly white, exclusively Christian men, with a...
Maybe it's appropriate, it's football stadiums, considering their founder.
Yes, who's a football coach from the Dallas Buffaloes, former football coach. But I think it's appropriate to be discussing Promise Keepers following the discussion you just had on the moves in the Senate to override Clinton's veto of the partial birth abortion ban, because explicit in Promise Keepers' ideology is a call for keeping women in submission. With the discussion of Senator Santorum, one of the key spokespersons for Promise Keepers, an African-American pastor named Joseph Garlington, had served on the steering committee of the committee to reelect to elect Senator Santorum. Now, recently in Los Angeles, Promise Keepers staged an enormous rally with 50,000 men. And at that event, Wellington Boone, a pastor from Atlanta, explicitly called for women to be put in submission.
Let's talk for a minute about this whole idea. And we pulled a bit of sound from the videotape you did on the Promise Keepers on this very issue of women and submission.
Men or man is the promise keeper, but watch this. Wives become the promise reapers, and then subsequently your children are the promise seekers because of a tremendous responsibility that the Lord also has given the wife in terms of submitting to the husband. And if this woman is going to submit to us this way, then let me tell you something, guys. We're going to give her a reason to submit.
We are very grateful for you. We need you.
ask you to forgive us for not showing you respect and the honor you deserve. We're very grateful that you came. We love you, and we're praying for you, and we ask that you would pray for us, that the Lord will help us through this transition time so that we can learn how to love you and honor you and cherish you the way you deserve. Thank you very much.
And that woman, because this is a mass of men who meet at these stadiums, was there on videotape to offer her forgiveness.
Yes, one of the most chilling moments there was after she begs forgiveness from the 50,000 men there and talks about helping them in this transition time.
And this was at which stadium?
At the Los Angeles Coliseum a couple of months ago. Begs for assistance in this transition time, which is the transition time of women into a period of submission to men. This is the attempt, really, to resegregate American politics and social order along gender lines. And as the economy continues to impact communities of color, increasingly segregating society again on racial lines, the resegregation also now on gender lines is ominous indeed.
Let's talk about who is supporting the Promise Keepers, who's the financing behind it, and the founder, how he got involved with it as well.
Well, part of the myth about Promise Keepers, Amy, is that it's not political at all. In fact, this is totally absurd. Coach McCartney, who was the founder of Promise Keepers in 1990, had been an anti-reproductive rights activist for a long time and still is. He had spoken at rallies of the militantly anti-reproductive rights organization Operation Rescue. He had also been on the advisory board of Colorado for Family Values, which sponsored Amendment 2, the anti-gay initiative out in Colorado. Conservative Supreme Court actually struck that down as a violation of civil rights. So the founder of this organization has been actively involved in politics. And if one's going to look at the major speakers, one finds a long tradition of right-wing activism as well. In addition to the people who are initiating and running the organization, a quick look at the backers of the organization also reveals a very open political agenda. When Promise Keepers was first initiated, Campus Crusade for Christ, run by Bill Bright, an extreme right-wing religious activist, gave them at least 85 full-time staff to get it going. There is still a huge number of Campus Crusade for Christ staff at the National Office of Promise Keepers in Denver. Pat Robertson has endorsed it. The California chapter of the Christian Coalition is about to give an award to the president of Promise Keepers. James Dobson's Focus on the Family publishes the top theoretical books of Promise Keepers. And James Dobson, as many of you know, has taken a political position to the right of Pat Robertson, working closely with his colleague Bauer. So behind the organization, at the top of the organization, you have people with an open agenda. And so this myth of no politics is an absurdity. Additionally, if the economic agenda of the supporters of Promise Keepers was carried into effect, exemplified by this group of first-term Republicans, communities of color in this country would be decimated.
It's interesting you say that, because in today's New York Daily News, there's a piece on how 24 African-American and Latino ministers said yesterday they'd encourage their congregants to attend the male-only Christian rally at Shea Stadium to help bridge the racial gap among the city's Christians.
Well, I think that's really a tragedy. There's a lot of deliberate naivete, one might say, going on here. Where people who have had a tradition of conservative activism, and I must say in the Daily News article, they lead off quoting A.R. Bernard, who'd been a senior activist with Farrakhan, whose recent march and Promise Keepers plans to have their Million Man Men's March next September also excluded women. So now instead of one religious figure, Muhammad, now it's Jesus. But the anti-women's message remains clear in the organizations he's supporting. If one were to look at the black leadership in Promise Keepers, Wellington Boone, John Perkins, E.V. Hill, Joseph Garlington, those four, who are probably the most important of the spokespersons from the African-American community, have all been on the steering committee of an extreme right-wing organization called Coalition on Revival. Wellington Boone, who delivered the tirade in California about women in submission, started his career very early working with Pat Robertson on a book. He's also one of the editors of Coalition on Revival's magazine called Crosswinds. He sits on the editorial board with Peter Hammond, a notorious South African and formerly Rhodesian military operative who had been arrested, picked up by the Mozambique authorities for espionage, working with the South African death squad RENAMO.
RENAMO actually is the organization that that Jack Kemp championed when he was a Congress member.
That's correct. E.V. Hill, another African-American pastor from Los Angeles, had referred to the ACLU as satanic and twice headed clergy for Reagan. Now, it may well be that this extremely right-wing group of activists are able to induce some more liberal African-American and Hispanic pastors to collaborate with this effort to create a right-wing movement. But I think it would be tragic if that were to succeed at all.
What about the military kind of structure that the Promise Keeper has around the country? I've heard some of the speeches from around the stadiums and coliseums, and they talk about that kind of military rigor.
Yes, well, Coach McCartney himself has referred to this, and in the Atlanta conference, and last February, Promise Keepers pulled together the largest meeting of clergy in human history, 39,000 clergy packed into the Georgia Dome to hear the propaganda message of this right-wing organization. At that event, there was an announcement there would be a luncheon for military chaplains. A number of active-duty military chaplains attended, including 15 from Fort Bragg. There, the group was addressed by a former Air Force Brigadier General who heads Campus Crusades for Christ's military ministry and a former Green Beret who'd worked with the Joint Chiefs in the Pentagon, discussing how they're trying to actively recruit in the military. And a subsequent event at Fort Bragg was held, with Wellington Boone, by the way, speaking, to recruit within the military. Beyond that, it's important to note that although the stadium events have attracted most of the publicity, the strategic goal of Promise Keepers is to set up an enormous infrastructure of what they call small groups, basically cells across the United States, and they've set up 8,000 of these. So the stadium event, which is going to be staged at Shea Stadium Friday evening and all day Saturday, is really to recruit people, but for the purpose of moving them into these small groups.
We're talking to Al Ross. He is the head of an organization called Sterling Research Associates. They've been focusing on the Promise Keepers and have a report out called Promise Keepers, the Third Wave of the American Religious Right. Why is this so popular? You're talking about packing the Georgia Dome at to the tune of tens of thousands of ministers, which is the largest gathering of ministers in history. You're talking about tens of thousands of people packing stadiums around the country. What is the draw?
Well, I think part of the draw is a reaction among men, the same way after the Civil Rights Movement, there was a white racist reaction to the gains of communities of color in participating and being empowered in our society. Certainly, this movement is drawing massively on men's reaction to the growing rights of women. Additionally, certainly there are certain problems of identity crisis and adjustment to a real civil rights reality in the United States, also with pressures of growing pressures of unemployment, and the economic situation is creating crises of identity. The problem, of course, is these anti-democratic movements have traditionally grown in that kind of an environment. Unfortunately, although in the short term it creates a community of sympathizers that can identify together with their problems and advocate their own superiority. But, of course, in the long run, their programs and ideology only exacerbates the problem. We've seen this over and over again, certainly in Europe, a number of decades ago.
Now, some observers of the right have said that this actually isn't as political an organization as some of the others right religious organizations. The fact, the proof of this, is that they were going to have a march this year on Washington, but they decided to put it off so that it wouldn't be perceived as fiercely political.
That's right. Well, at the moment, as I mentioned, Promise Keepers was created by people who had been actively involved in right-wing politics. They then pretty much clearly decided that now they had to recruit a larger base. So they take leave from their activist politics, although, of course, Dobson and Robertson and the others who are backing it have already taken leave from their activist right-wing politics. But now they want to create this enormous base, an enormous movement, and an enormous grassroots infrastructure with what they hope will be a non-political facade. But as I said earlier, it would be just deliberately naive on our part to assume that Dobson and Robertson and his cohorts have given up politics. I mean, why are these the major organizations that are sponsoring it? And why is nearly every spokesperson for Promise Keepers at the events have a long history of right-wing politics?
Have there been any protests outside of Promise Keeper events?
There have been some. In Seattle recently, Promise Keepers had a major event. And there was some grassroots activism on it. Unfortunately, to date, a number of large progressive organizations and the liberal churches have held off on challenging Promise Keepers. It's tragic. They held off too long on challenging Pat Robertson until he was formally enormously entrenched within the Republican Party. We can only hope that this kind of situation doesn't continue with Promise Keepers.
Again, as we sum up, can you say why you think, I mean, your organization, Sterling Research Associates, dedicates itself, it says, to threats against democracy, why you see the Promise Keepers, a massive growing movement of men, mainly white men, as a threat to democracy in this country?
Well, I see it as a threat to the democratic process because they're deliberately concealing the real agenda of the leadership and so on. People, of course, are free to choose abortion or not, or what political organizations they wish to get involved with. But the democratic system can only function if people are aware of what's really the substance of these movements. And I think that's been a major problem with Promise Keepers. Coach McCartney has deliberately decided not to put forward his anti-choice positions at the speeches, and is talking about this myth of reconciliation. Certainly racial harmony is a political and economic issue. Promise Keepers is explicitly opposed to government involvement and legal action and economic action that can create a racial equality, and they deliberately chose the term reconciliation rather than equality to avoid having to deal with the substantive economic issues that can ultimately only themselves lead to solving the problem among the racial groups in this country.
Well, we'll continue to watch the former football coach Bill McCartney, former football coach of the, I believe it's Colorado Buffaloes, now head of Promise Keepers. And is there a number if people want to get a hold of your report, Promise Keepers, Al Ross?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, the Nation article is at the press now and should be out later today. And our phone number at Sterling Research in New York is area code 212-423-9237.
That's 212-423-9237. I want to thank you very much, Al Ross, Director of Sterling Research Associates here in New York. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Errol Maitland, and Kenneth Mason in Washington, our director, Brother Shine. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!